Not all players in the magazine world are created equal. Knowing the game is one thing, but writing your own set of rules is quite another. If publishing is a sport, any would-be champion must show ambition, flawless form, and seasoned skills. We'll look at some of the sharpest contenders today on The Stack. On today's programme, get ready to tighten your tennis skills with a brand new publication that captures the craft of the court.
It kind of feels to me like we have a slab of marble and it's in there. We know what we want to say, we know the writers we want to work with, we know the illustrators, which is not to say that we're not being overwhelmed constantly with fantastic ideas, but it kind of does feel like this idea should exist.
Editor David Shaftoe and publisher Caitlin Thompson will join me here in the studio. Plus, we'll review our champions of the newsstand this week with Monocle's own Grand Slam title holder. It's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Game, set and match as we hit off 30 minutes of print industry news and analysis today on The Stack. David and Caitlin, welcome to The Stack. Great to have you with us. We've admired, I don't know if you heard, we admired racket, I think a few weeks ago, so hopefully that sets us off in good stead. Caitlin, perhaps I'll start with you, though, as the publisher. Tell me about this. It's kind of my stock question to anybody who starts a magazine is, what's wrong with you? Are you mad? Is that part of your thinking? You know, you know the world of journalism and publishing well. Is there always part of you that approaches something like this with trepidation? Or is it one of those things where all the bits come together and you felt, yeah, the chemistry is just right. We're going to make a go of this.
We are certainly mad. David and I have full-time jobs, children, three between us. He's got two, I've got one. So madness is definitely part of the essential chemistry of this idea. I think for us, we are doing something so close to our hearts. We are lifelong tennis fans, lifelong tennis players. And I think we sort of took a look at the landscape. Both of us coming from mass media understood it to be just a series of disruptions. I used to work at the Washington Post, Time Magazine. David's worked for every possible media company you can imagine, New York Times, FT, you know, and it's really tough out there for people to do broad casting. I think that we're sort of entering an era now where it's going to shift into narrow casting. And I think for us, both the combination of a vibrant community, largely spearheaded by you guys at Monocle, but also just every possible niche having a really strong editorial presence, and the fact that nothing like this exists for tennis. The tennis community has been very woefully underserved by, especially sort of a high-minded literary approach. On one hand, we are starting from scratch. We've never made a magazine before, so that's where the madness is. But I think for us also, it kind of feels to me like we have a slab of marble and it's in there. We know what we want to say. We know the writers we want to work with. We know the illustrators, which is not to say that we're not being overwhelmed constantly with fantastic ideas, but it kind of does feel like this idea should exist. You guys were speaking to Jeremy Leslie a couple of weeks ago. I'm a fan of the show, and I was listening to the episode, and I was so grateful that he mentioned, oh, this is just such an obvious thing, the marriage of tennis and this literary sort of approach. So that's really truly what's sort of, I think, pushing us forward day to day, knowing that it should exist.
Well, David, this is, again, a question I put to a lot of people who start out magazines, is what comes first? Is it that question of identifying a niche that's not filled? But there, I guess there always has to be the marriage with your passion. Is your sort of passion, your conviction to do more great writing, to source more great writing and art and images about tennis, is that so overwhelming that you'd kind of have to do this, you know, even if there were 20 other titles that were doing what this is trying to do?
Well, if there were 20 other titles, I'm not sure.
Okay,
we might have done something different.
Maybe one or two.
But it's kind of a no-brainer because there isn't really, tennis is underserved in the print media, and I mean, even in the mainstream media, so-called mainstream media, is covered during the Grand Slams and then it goes away. So on the one hand, there was this obvious need for a tennis publication, but on the other hand, what I always like to say is that, you know, I got into this because I love tennis. We both love tennis, but I also, you know, see it as much as a venture into publishing and to do journalism on our own terms and be in publishing. And, you know, I'm a writer, I'm a freelance feature writer by trade. And this allows me to think visually and photo edit and commission illustrations and think about a lot of stuff that I don't get to do just working in a vacuum as a writer, which is also very isolating work. And I get to work with my friend Caitlin and other great contributors.
And what about that idea of going to publishing, did you approach that with any trepidation, or did you kind of think, hey, look, I've spoken to a few people, I reckon I can nail this.
It's all trepidation. But, you know, Caitlin was talking about, and you guys had touched on the idea of a business model, a model for a small scale business, but we felt like the numbers were there to survive, to make it viable. So of course there's trepidation, and especially as you publish one and you see what the numbers look like, because you don't know where it's going to sell, how much it's going to sell, when you get that money, how it, you know, if you get money, what the bank account looks like. So of course there's trepidation, but you know, we feel confident that we can make it at least survive, and then the goal is to grow and do other things off the back of the magazine and sort of the world we hope to create through the magazine.
Okay, and that's interesting. Let's maybe pick up on that, because the first edition was funded, I guess, fair to say, principally through a Kickstarter campaign. Lots of backers in the several hundreds, but you're quite set on having a different funding formula as the business grows and goes forwards. And that's quite interesting to me that you've obviously thought about that, and there's a clear strategy there, which there isn't always for some of these nascent projects.
I'm glad you think it's clear.
But, you know, how important was that to keep that in mind? Because obviously, you know, with these new projects, the excitement of the, you know, issue one, that can kind of run away with you.
Right.
You managed to keep that always in mind. How did you sort of manage to do that? And how did you build that idea for what that business plan would look like?
Well, I think, you know, you're talking to us when we are nearly ready to go to print with issue two. Mm. So we've now had the benefit of being out in the world with issue one, seeing the response, seeing what really resonated with people, understanding what transcended our powerful and big, but also sort of insular tennis world, and really, resonated with people outside of it. And I think, yes, the business model for the magazine product, the print product itself, was always, and the reason we crowdfunded, it was because it was always centered on the concept of reaching a community, putting something out that was extremely high touch, tactile, emotional, really felt essential and elegant, and the idea that the numbers didn't have to be enormous, but as long as they were willing to commit, trust us with our editorial direction, trust that we were going to source the best illustration and take a journey and make weird choices when we wanted to, was the entire premise. And I think for us, also going into it, having studied up and listened to shows like this and met with a lot of other independent magazine makers, and also studying, you know, Wink Creative and trying to understand that if we can establish a sensibility and be as confident editorially as we are curatorially and really create something that feels like an entire ecosystem, then it's possible for us, looking at the landscape of not only the journalism that surrounds tennis, but the branding, the sort of sponsorship, the entire world is due for a reboot. And we are both in our like late 30s and early 40s, and we have such a passionate memories of this time in the 70s and 80s and early 90s when it was really energetic and buccaneering. And we see the game as something that is ripe to be reclaimed in that way. And so for me, sure, the print model and the core product needs to be absolutely excellent. And I'm confident that our second issue is actually even better because of the work that Dave is doing in day in and day out. But also thinking as a launch pad for going to a tournament and rebranding their entire look and feel and handouts and posters and anything that sort of surrounds it was always really important to us, whether that's a video project or a documentary or a photo book, you know, really trying to think, okay, let's make it clear who we are, and then the stuff that we really could get excited to do and maybe even create more of a margin for ourselves, not to bring this back to business, but that's not a small consideration, then we can branch out from there. And so we're kind of approaching it all in, which makes it harder, but at the same time, we think it will land us sort of on firmer, more creative, exciting ground, I think.
Mm. David, it's interesting to pick up on this idea about illustration, bold choices. I know issue two is imminent, but if we go back with one, and I think maybe when we spoke about Racket on this program, we talked first of all about how arresting and how striking the cover is. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can, this is radio, one of the limitations. We don't have any little cameras in here. Just remind our listeners about what number one looks like, and tell me a bit about that process, because I don't know with you guys whether it's the first thing or the last thing you did. Often people say it's the heaviest, the decision that rests least easily on their narrow shoulders. How did you decide to go in this direction?
Well, this was the first thing we did, and we had it really early on. It's an illustration of a player called Yannick Noah. Your listeners may know.
They should know. If they don't, get on the internet.
They should find out. He's the last Frenchman to win the French Open, which he did in 1983, and he was my favorite player growing up, and that's why he's on the cover. But he also when we had the idea for the magazine, we thought, who is the person or who are the people that really will telegraph the game as we'd like to see it? And Noah was really the first choice. He's multicultural. He doesn't look like your typical tennis player. He's half French, half Cameroonian. He was discovered by Arthur Ashe on a charity tour of Africa. He had a very flashy game, very exciting to watch, but was also successful. French tennis is sort of, and we have a story in there that corresponds with that illustration on sort of how disappointing French tennis is. They have amazing players, but they can't really get it together. So Noah was sort of the first choice. And a lot of the sort of nostalgic imagery out of the tennis world that we love are these tennis travel posters of the, you know, the 20s through the 70s, really, when tennis had this great visual identity, which is more or less gone now. So it's an illustration by a Danish poster artist called Mads Berg, who works in a sort of updated version of that classic travel poster style. So he was an obvious choice to do it, and he's set on a red cover, which mirrors the red clay of Roland Garros, where the French Open is played. Yeah, we just thought it was a very strong color to have, you know, very striking and dynamic cover. Noah is in the midst of a
big sweeping kind of a forehand. Forehand kind of semi-sweeping smash shot, I don't know. And it has such kind of a visceral newsstand appeal. I often talk to people about what jumps out of newsstands. Were you mindful of the fact that, you know, it needed to be something where people would go, hang on a minute, what is that? And I guess you could have, were you worried about overcooking that? I think it's, I mean, it's so perfect to me, but I mean, did you agonize over it or did it just fall into place?
Well, we had another choice for the cover, which is a promo we did, which is just a green grass of a tennis court with a line and a ball, very minimalist, and I still love it. And we just workshopped it around and the feedback was that it's too passive. So
not an accusation that could be leveled at this.
So we went in the other direction. I'm glad we did. And another thing we thought about with this cover a lot was how it feels and how I wanted some texture because tennis courts have texture. And we wanted it to feel expensive but also feel fast was something I kept saying. I wanted to be able to bend it to the pages to move quickly, something you can use in the stands at a tournament, something that you can spill a beer on and wipe it off and the magazine's going to survive. So
These are all the perfect considerations, trust me. Time is short, so we must move on. Now, you said volume two, Caitlin, imminent. I mean, can you share anything about what we have in store? I mean, people will now be waiting with bated breath to hear more.
I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, I can give you sort of a general thematic idea. I think one of the shortcomings of the first issue, as proud of it as we are, and as much great writing as we feel like we got, was that we weren't exactly sure when we were going to be able to start the cycle of an annual quarterly publication. So not knowing exactly when we were going to go to press, not knowing exactly how that was going to line up with the ongoing tennis tour, made it so that we wanted to lock in a lot of stuff that we knew could just be totally untethered to any sort of cyclical conversation. I mean, this is not a very newsy or topical publication by design, but we did make a conscious effort to sort of lock in a sort of cycle as soon as we got going. And the second issue is an Australasia issue. We felt it was really important. It's going to be coming out in early January, which will correspond with the beginning of the tour in Australia and New Zealand. And the idea that there is an entire life cycle of the tennis game outside of sort of the Western European understanding of what that means, which is essentially from like April to September. No, actually, there's a huge sweep through Asia. There's hard courts. There's all these incredible players. There's Arab players. There's all these tournaments in Doha and Dubai and the Emirates and in Australia, of course, who are just littered with fantastically interesting players. There's a lot of history there. There's sort of courts that are on the verge of being decommissioned. They're kind of forgotten because they were from a time when not every player traveled down there, and so they were built with a sort of smaller audience in mind. And so we kind of felt like there was enough thematic resonance that we came up very early with blue. That's all we decided. We just wanted something.
Everyone agreed blue.
Blue.
Which correspondingly is the color of the courts in Melbourne at the Australian Open.
Well, you see, I wondered, I was going to cheekily ask whether that could possibly be a thing. That's quite exciting to imagine how that's going to be rendered.
You didn't even have to ask us. So it's going to tie together, I think, a little bit more cohesively. And something that David talks a lot about, which we were just talking about the cover. One of the points of healthy tension between us is David is much more immersed in an art world than I am. And I'm a little bit more leaning towards the commercial and the flashy. And I'm trying to get sort of pop culture writers. And he's going towards more of the authors, which I think is a fantastic mix to have. And I think what will be an improvement drastically, in addition to having a bit of a tighter theme, is a much more visual, much more photographic, a little bit less text-heavy sort of experience, which I'm delighted with how the first one turned out. But now that we have, you know, sort of a tighter editorial calendar with what we're going for, it's a little easier to spend time and commission photos and commission visual packages in a way that I think will be even more sort of experientially, you know, satisfying.
And now that people know what it looks like, we're getting better ideas from people. You know, when it was theoretical, we had ideas that we thought were crazy. You know, people wondering how we're going to do a luxury magazine on such a small budget. Like, well, you know, it's not Golf Digest. It's something, just wait and see, wait and see. So now that people see what it is, we're having an easier time finding material and especially finding images and art. So we really want it to be more art-driven than it is. Although, like Caitlin, I'm happy with the mix in the first one as well.
We should be. You should be very proud. It's a great thing. And I for one, I cannot wait to see the second. I'll be counting the days down till January, the start of the new tennis season. There's a perfect accompaniment to it. While Britain maybe rules the world, just throw that in there, tennis-wise at the moment.
We're on board with that.
Yeah, we approve. We're into that.
David and Caitlin, look, it's fantastic to chat with you. Thanks so much for coming in to talk to us.
Thank you, Tom.
You're with The Stack on Monocle 24. From tennis to, I don't know, well, some other sporting titles are also on the agenda as we delve into a stack of magazines that The Stack's own Fernando Augusto Pacheco has brought with him today. Hello, Fernando.
Hello, Tom. I selected quite a few interesting magazines for us.
Well, and we have a kind of a sporting note to the show with racket, with lots of tennis talk. Should we start in the world of sport with your first selection?
Absolutely. And I have to say, Tom, I have to be honest, sports magazines are not really my favorite, but I'm a big fan of ESPN magazine, which is, you know, it comes out two times a month in the US. And it's interesting because you can't really find it in the UK, but they were very nice and they sent me a copy. And it's a really, really cool magazine, very well produced. And at the same time, you know, of course, they cover a lot of sports like, you know, American football, baseball, which, to be honest, I'm not an expert and is not my main area of interest.
And we should say, this is, of course, ESPN's bread and butter. It's this kind of sports network. It covers, in exhaustive detail through the depths of the divisions through the United States. And more widely, of course.
Absolutely. Basically, I have the new issue in front of me. There's this player, quarterback, Dak Prescott. He's on the cover. Apparently, he's doing very, very well at the moment.
Big story out of Dallas, Fernando.
Big story. But Tom, my favorite thing about the magazine is not really, you know, a profile of Dak, you know, Prescott, but basically, they have interesting features about sports that we don't hear that much. For example, like pinball. I mean, first of all, I thought, is it really a sport? But apparently it is.
Is it ever? And there's some amazing pictures in here. We've got hundreds of players playing professional pinball. There's no two ways to describe it. It looks like an aircraft hangar full of pinball machines.
Yeah, and it's called Pinburg, which is in Pittsburgh, and it happens every year.
Very clever.
And they did a huge profile, a 10-page story, I have to say, which is fantastic, about this player, Roberto Gagno. He's Italian-Canadian. Apparently, he's number one in Canada and the seventh best player in the world. And it's interesting, you know, he's telling how he found out that he was good at pinball. He was started playing when he was only five.
Precocious talent.
Very precocious.
And we should say, let's describe a little bit about ESPN Magazine, because what's interesting about it, you mentioned this long-form pieces, it's definitely got that kind of, like a really great Sunday supplement feel to it. The paper stock is similar to what you might find, you know, in a big European Sunday magazine. And the kind of stylistic, the aesthetic of it is similar to that. And I think it gives it it feels like a quality piece of print, doesn't it?
A lot of stats as well, which I do love a good stat. You know, I believe there's a story as well about how some American footballers, they're using marijuana. You know, apparently it improves their performance as well. And again, a very long feature about that. And Tone, we shouldn't forget, even though it's not this issue, they also have the yearly body issue. I don't know if you came across, you know, they have 10 different covers with naked athletes, you know. So that's a huge market.
What's not to enjoy, Fernando?
Exactly. You stole my words, Tone.
So, four star or five stars probably for ESPN magazine. Where should we go next?
We go to Turkey now. I have a new independent title called 212. That's issue 2. I think it just came out. I bought actually the kiosk affair at the Monaco very own news agent.
And this is a something of a giant of a magazine, isn't it?
Giant. I mean, it's A3 paper and it's like 190 pages. And I can see a trend at the moment in the newsstands as well, Tom, because you see magazines like Holiday or Luncheon, which is all about lunches. They have a similar format and they feel very... I think it's very chic, those kind of magazines, very indulgent in a way, you know, they're not kind of tiny and easy to read. You really need to sit down with a nice cup of coffee or your favorite beverage to enjoy. But, and again, for every issue of 212, which they're based in Turkey, I have to say, they choose like a, you know, a random theme. I believe in this issue is called locality. Mm. Of course, it's kind of a...
That's kind of open to interpretation. I think, but they've got some great, I mean, it's a wonderful photo essay of rodeo with, you know, kids on a rodeo. Rodeo horses, some amazing images of the countryside, incredible style. And again, it's probably quite traditional, would you say, the magazine, in terms of its appearance?
There's a 50s style to it as well. Yeah. Go to page 44, 45, if you may. There's a very interesting story they did about some bizarre hotels in the southern of Turkey, which imitates old European palaces. You know, it's very kitsch, and I was very much surprised. There's one that it looks like you're in Venice, in a way, but it's so surreal. It makes me want to go there as well. So
it's like a sort of a little Vegas, isn't it? Very much.
And continuing also our kind of nudity theme as well. You know, as you can see from the cover, they did a profile with some oil wrestlers in Turkey as well. It's quite an erotic photo shoot, but again, very, very well made by 212. I think it's more at the end of the magazine. Don't be shocked, Tom.
That's right. Yeah, no, I mean, I've leafed through. They also have a thing about a suggestive snack that's available in Turkey. Have you seen this?
I've seen that. It's... quite interesting.
Check it out, listeners. judge for yourselves. Faye, where next?
Of course, you know, being Brazilian, I have to choose a Brazilian title, but that's something that I never commented here on the stack. It's a magazine called Amarelo, which is basically about contemporary culture. That's how they call themselves. Mm. I mean, you know, you should live through the magazine. I have to be honest, on what I like is not that much the content, but I do like the design of this magazine. There's, you know, a lot of... paintings by Brazilian artists, you know, a lot of poems. It's really, you know, a bit random sometimes, a bit like 212 in a way. Mm. But, you know, Amarelo is doing very, very well. That's issue 25 already. And it's a quarterly publication in Brazil. And they have amazing ads as well. As you can see on the back of the magazine, they have Prada, Saint Laurent. That's not very common in Brazilian magazines as well.
It's a really beautiful magazine. They have some brilliant features. Obviously, a lot of the nuance is lost on me with my... being limited only to the English language, but they have a beautiful portfolio shoot with some incredible artworks, which I think is also the cover star, and they've got a partially foiled cover. It's a small format, but it's a really beautiful piece of work.
That's the work of Brazilian artist Bruna Canepa, you know, from the cover. And, you know, you can see that this is actually a rocket. And again, the issue has a theme, and it's called Spatial, the Spatial issue. I think they were trying to play with the words. It's a little bit about spaces and space itself in the universe.
I'm a big fan, Fernando. This is a really great, brilliant photo shoot of here, of some tops of buildings. Excellent.
And as I said, I'm glad, you know, it's still issue 25, it's still doing very well with a lot of ads. And I think that's always a good sign as well in the
industry.
Certainly is.
Faye, how many more have we got left?
We've got two.
A couple more.
You know, we love newspaper supplements here, a newspaper magazine, Stone. We spoke a lot about Zeit magazine, which is a great issue as well. But one magazine, I'm not sure if we mentioned on the stack before, is the Le Monde publication that comes every weekend, Le Magazine du Monde. I think it's a great publication. I believe since 2004, it became like a weekly supplement coming on Le Monde weekend. And I was in Paris recently, so I grabbed a copy. And basically, in their last issue, they have a beautiful story about the Bataclan, full of, you know, pictures, you know, interviews with people who have been connected to the incident about a year ago. And I think they did a fantastic, really, really good job there. But they have also some interesting articles. For example, they have a story how politics and food in France, after Sarkozy's comments that, you know, kids, if they can't eat pork, they have to eat fries, you know, and they were talking about other examples in France's political history of this happen. I don't know if you know a guy, he's a politician. Basically, in 2012, he said that, oh, French kids now, if they're eating a pain au chocolat, they'll be attacked on the streets because people say, oh, you shouldn't eat this because it's Ramadan. And he became well known in France as Le Pain au chocolat. Did you get the joke?
Yeah, very nice. Yeah.
So I think it's a great publication.
And again, this is proper grown-up journalism, isn't it? There's some brilliant photo stories, of course, looking at Paris a year on. I guess you were there a year after the Paris attacks. But as you say, other, you know, slices of life, vignettes, proper good, you know, weekend stuff to dive into. And again, it has a good quality look and feel to it. You feel like this is a magazine that has some proper investment in it, which is
and,
nice.
And we do have to mention the newspapers, magazines, they're upping their game. I mean, this, we have quite a few examples, like Il as well from Il Sole 24 in Italy, you know, the New York Times magazine, among a couple of others as well.
Exactly. Well, it's nice for a good news story. Now, Faye, to finish, I see a title here, Cover Side Down. You're going to surprise me with this last one. What have you got?
I didn't want to tell you before because you might be a bit scared, but it is a very successful publication. It's People. And Tom, do you know how many copies People sell every single week in the United States?
I know it's a lot. I can't remember.
It is
a lot. Hit me with the figure.
3.5 million copies. Wow. Still. So it's a fantastic number. And I wouldn't call it my favorite magazine, but I do admire... I do buy a couple of weeks a year, and especially in this last issue as well.
The Sexiest Man Alive edition.
Exactly. I mean, it's not my fault, but it's one of the best-selling issues of the year. And of course, the man they chose this time is Dwayne The Rock Johnson as well. And it's interesting because, you know, we have to say that People is not... I would call it a gossip magazine. I would say it's more kind of a celebrity lifestyle. I think they really check the resources. They wouldn't publish.
I was going to ask you about
lies.
This genre-defying, whether it's it's a celebrity magazine, but it's maybe it's blurring that boundary. It's a little into kind of lifestyle. It's a sort of entertainment, I guess, as well, maybe to a degree.
Absolutely. And there was an interesting page, like, you can be beautiful at any age, Tom. So, I mean, I'm not going to ask you...
Is that directed pointedly at me, Fernando?
I'm not going to ask
Let's keep it polite.
I'm not going to ask your age on air, but hopefully I can find it here. So you can see, you know, no matter what your age, there's always a handsome man to match.
Okay.
I can see, I don't mind saying my age. I'm 30. I'm apparently the same age as Ki Hong Lee. I didn't know him.
Okay.
Have a look at yours. You don't need to say it on air if you don't want to.
Okay, very good looking guys. Yeah, I don't know who any of these people are. But yeah, that's happy. That's reassuring. Sexy at every age.
Yeah.
These men prove, Fernando, that sexiness has no sell-by date.
Absolutely.
Helpful for that, if nothing else. That's People. That's Fernando Augusto Pacheco guiding us through his pick of the newsstand this week. Fernando, thanks for being on the programme. And that is all we have time for on this week's programme. My thanks to David and Caitlin earlier, thanks to our producers Ben Ryland and to Fernando, of course, and to our editor Claire Urban. Comments or queries are welcome as ever. Drop a note to Fernando. He is on fp@monocle.com. And don't forget to join us at the same time next weekend. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks for listening.